Hello and welcome to Eco Justice Radio. My name is JP Morris, and today we have an interview hosted by Carrie Kim. She'll be talking to Eric Olson. Eric Olson is the director of the Permaculture Skills Center, a vocational training school that offers advanced education in ecological design, landscaping, farming, and land stewardship. Creator of the Eco Landscape Mastery School online training program, Eric is also founder of Permaculture Artisans, which specializes in design and installation of ecological landscapes and farms throughout California. So let's get on with this wonderful interview hosted by Carrie. You're listening to Eco Justice Radio.
Aloha. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Carrie Kim, and we're here tonight with Eric Olson, co-founder of Permaculture Living Skills Center. And Eric, thank you so much for coming to join us tonight.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, given the many challenges we witnessed in the past years, especially this year, it's really important to inspire our listeners and to motivate them to continue contributing and participating to our world. So you're a perfect guest. We wanted to give them a little break from doom and gloom.
Thank goodness. There's a lot to be hopeful for.
So you have 20-some years of experience and expertise working in permaculture and ecological design and education. And some of our listeners, you know, I still run into people who don't even know what the term permaculture means. So if we could just start at the beginning, if you can share with our listeners from your own lived, embodied experience, what is permaculture?
Permaculture is a variety of different design processes and a movement as well. So here's the short of it. It's a design system that is based on principles that we find in nature. It's how we design our communities, our gardens, our cities, our lives, the same way that nature would design a forest or a watershed. So it's looking at all the components of our culture and of human settlement and civilization, like clean water, food, shelter, energy, community, and then designing it like we would design a garden.
Mm-hmm. Can you just give our listeners kind of, I know you can't just squeeze permaculture down to that, but I think one of the good examples is just when someone creates an herb garden outside their home, how they would approach that from a permaculture perspective. I mean, I'm sure there's many things to consider, but just a little tidbit for our listeners to understand.
Well, in nature, nature conserves energy. And so good design is going to conserve energy. So when we're growing herbs or vegetables, one of the best permaculture really specific techniques you can apply is the zoning method, which is basically that you place plants that require daily maintenance as close to your house as possible. So that way, these are plants that you want to harvest them every day. You want to check on them. And Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, he actually had the wet slipper test, which is, you know, you're making up some breakfast in the morning and you need to go out and get some garlic chives. And if your slippers are wet when you come back in, they're too far away.
I see. That's really funny. Yeah, that's great. It's important for people to understand because I'm surprised, but I still do run into a lot of people. They don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, nowadays we also hear the term regenerative agriculture a lot. And I'm wondering if you could kind of share, you know, around when did the languaging really shift from sustainability to one of regeneration or regenerative ag? It's something to track.
Absolutely. Well, what happened with the word sustainability is it more or less got co-opted and, you know, sort of greenwashed by corporations to say we're being sustainable because we're recycling or we're, you know, we've reduced our waste by 10% or we've reduced our energy use by 25%. I mean, those are all great, but they're still not really addressing the problem. And so regenerative design really sort of became a bit popular in the last 10 years. And what that speaks to is a way of working with the land, whether it's growing food or it's stewardship, or it's landscape design, that actually enhances the ecological processes that are already going on, like the carbon cycle, the water cycle, building soil. So when we approach a landscape or a farm for regeneration, one of our goals isn't just to yield, you know, a crop, but it's to actually yield topsoil, to yield clean water, to yield, you know, fire protection, habitat.
Yeah, so you end up not just maintaining, you go beyond maintaining. It's like promoting instead of just holding, you know, holding steady.
Yeah, and this is how nature functions. That one of the really exciting things lately for me is I've been harvesting redwood seeds, because old growth redwood, I live in Northern California, and the old growth redwood is the largest carbon sequestering terrestrial tree in the world. And so earlier this year, I started harvesting redwood seeds, and in one redwood cone, there's about 200 redwood seeds.
That's amazing.
That's regeneration. That's creating surplus. That's creating abundance. And that's how, when we're designing with permaculture and we're designing regeneratively, that's how we're designing our cities and our communities and our gardens and our landscapes and our farms for the surplus, for the abundance, for nature and for people.
You know, when I was watching some of your videos on your website, I could really tell that you have this urgency to want to teach people and to scale up what's happening with regeneration. And if you could tell me, why are you so focused on teaching people to create regenerative careers?
Well, if we look at the current economy, which is so destructive and so extractive, and you think about the last few hundred years where we've literally turned forest to desert, we've destroyed rivers, we've destroyed watersheds. So we know how to destroy, and that's how the current economy is functioning in that way. But if you now think about, well, what would it take if we woke up inside our hearts and our minds as people and realized that we have the power to heal nature and heal ourselves? What would it take to scale that in such a way that we could take on the crisis at the scale that we're currently living in? And one of the things that became clear to me after 20 years of activism, working with nonprofit organizations, grassroots groups, community building, and starting my own businesses, is that this can't be a hobby anymore. You know, we have to get funding and momentum behind this work. And so I started to kind of dream up, well, what would it be like if instead of people spending their 40 hours or whatever their work week looks like doing things that are extractive from nature, extractive from the community, what if we built an economy that was focused on the regeneration, focused on the building soil and reforesting the deserts that were once forests? And, you know, and how would we do that? And so there's a lot of ways to do that. There's nonprofit organizing, there's small business development, and one of my missions lately has been to help people start their own careers in regenerative design, so people who are passionate about it and that's their lifelong path. It's like, you don't have to go work a separate job. You don't have to go wait tables. So then you can volunteer on the weekend and be an activist. Why don't you just learn to provide services that are inherently regenerating our world? And have that be the career. Care for your family to doing that work. Care for yourself for doing that work.
Yeah.
And so that's why I started my online school, the Eco Landscape Mastery School, was because I've noticed that a lot of folks who are turned on about permaculture and regenerative design or regenerative agriculture, they have a lot of passion. They have a lot of skills in many cases. But most folks don't know how to organize themselves in a way to where they can
run a
small business or an organization and like really professionalize that work.
So what does a regenerative economy look like to you?
Well, so to me, a regenerative economy, one, looks like a focus on bioregionalism, on localization. And one of my favorite memes that came out of the global justice movement in the early 2000s was globalized localization.
I love that.
So that's one focus. You know, globalized localization. That's really, if we're going to be regenerative, we have to do it in our own communities.
Exactly.
The second part is that we have to be site specific. So understanding that the solution for a system in Los Angeles is going to be totally different than a solution in San Francisco, because the culture might be different. The soil is different. The climate is different. The water is different. So if we want to be successful in creating our regenerative economy, then we have to understand the constraints and resources of the ecosystems that we're working within.
Yeah.
That takes observation. That takes listening. And then the third part of that is that inherent in the work we do, we have a cultural ethos that is focused on caring for Earth and caring for people.
And would you link that also with people's cultural traditions, their actual ancestral heritage as well? Is that, are you thinking along
those lines? Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think that if in order for us to be successful in regenerating at scale, we have to follow the lead of indigenous communities.
Absolutely.
Because indigenous communities, you know, they hold the key, the story of the land.
Yeah.
And so if we truly want to understand, like, for instance, here in Northern California, where I am, last year we got hit by the big fires in Sonoma County, Tubbs Fire.
Yep.
And when I opened myself up to the stories that the indigenous community here were telling us, the realization came that this isn't unknown. It might be unprecedented at this scale, but actually the native people here have been tracking this fire for 10,000 years.
Yeah, it's hard for people even to fathom the amount of time, you know, the millennia that they've been witnessing fire.
Really, really. And so I feel like it's this opportunity for us to follow the lead of native people, to listen to the stories. And I think that it's all of our responsibility now in this day and age that we all really, we need to re-indigenize ourselves now.
Absolutely.
Where we are.
Yeah. In the land. I mean, one of the things that I think about, well, first I want to go back to the fires because I know you personally, I don't know how close it came to your actual physical home. I know it was in your community. But, you know, often we see that nature is portrayed as an enemy when things like this happen. It's always perceived as a destructive force instead of what can we learn from it and what does it teach us about how we've been living. And so, you know, or poorly designing things and poorly we're not tending to the land or stewarding the land properly, obviously, in many ways. So, you know, you speak in terms of collaborating with nature, but how do we shift the mindset of modern people to really collaborating with nature instead of being, you know, part of it is just getting them back into nature.
Absolutely. I think these fires are a big wake-up call for a lot of people, and it's rippling all the way up to the state and federal level. And these fires, while they're destructive, there is a side to them, which is a blessing, which is that they're a natural part of the land, these landscapes. They need to burn.
Right.
And one of the reasons we have fires at the scale that we're at has everything to do with the way we've designed our communities, the way we've built up our neighborhoods, and clearly the effect that we're having on a changing climate. And so within all of that, one big question that we have here, and I'm just 8 miles from the fires last year, and all my family evacuated to my house for 10 days. So we were very closely in many childhood, sacred childhood places of mine burned to the ground. And, you know, this whole community was put through a traumatic experience, which is on a collective scale, has really changed the way we see each other and the way we see the land and development. And there's a lot of good potential coming out of the rebuild and many, many good connections and barriers that are being removed now towards legalizing sustainability, you know, legalizing regenerative practices, because that's...
When you say that, what exactly do you mean when you say legalizing sustainability? You mean
For instance... even just the act of catching your own water or using gray water in some jurisdictions have legal consequences. You either need to get permits or the county or city won't even give you a permit. And, you know, living in a drought-stricken California, these are basic tactics for having water security, is implementing gray water and water catchment. And one thing that's been really promising is that since Santa Rosa lost thousands of structures, City of Santa Rosa, in the rebuild efforts now, they are encouraging property owners to install rain catchment systems, graywater systems, food forests.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, we'll see what happens in places like Malibu. You know, I think of things. I mean, we just had a approval of a development down here that is in a fire zone, and it's kind of hard to fathom that that recently got approved down here. It's a 19,000 home development that is in a fire zone. And, you know, it's just hard to see those things happening because, you know, one of the things you mentioned is that the devastation from the recent fires in California has to do with illiteracy of ecological patterns. And sometimes we know the patterns to some degree, but still we're going against the patterns in the building.
Absolutely. And one of the ways that we counteract that is being very well organized in our communities and electing people who have this literacy already. Mm-hmm. And I feel hopeful because of the community. I live in Sonoma County. For the past 30 years, people have been organizing to get educated, conscious people into city councils, board of supervisors,
right,
like city staff, county staff. And now we have literally permaculture-trained people making decisions at city and county levels.
That's amazing. I mean, I think we're seeing that begin to happen because people realize, well, we've abdicated too much for too long, being in these sort of governmental offices and really being involved at that level, I would say. And, you know, and then I have this question for you. You know, much of what we're witnessing with climate change, as we know, is no longer 100% predictable. And so are you finding it harder to find patterns in an unpredictable world?
It's unpredictable because fires and storms and events have a level of an extreme level that we maybe haven't witnessed. But when you are working close to the land and you're planting seeds and you're moving water and you spend every day out in nature observing interactions between trees and birds and plants and soil and climate, there are so many stable patterns
mm-hmm.
right now in every one of our ecosystems mm-hmm. that just with a little bit of tending,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of support, and sometimes the non-action, actually, being able to read our landscapes in such a way so that we can understand better whether non-action is
the action.
More regenerative choice versus doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we are going to do something, are we working with succession, with the natural patterns that are playing out? And that's why I think it's so important, why I'm so passionate about teaching people permaculture design and regenerative design, is because I think the skill that so many of us have lost through our disconnection with our ancestors, the skill of being able to read the land and mm-hmm. on any given day
mm.
and have and yield tangible information around how to think about water, how to think about food, habitat, shelter, climate.
Right.
These are skills we all have inherently in us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can sort of awaken to that, then we'll know what to do.
Right.
Being
able to listen. What seems also one of the important things is being able to slow down and take time to observe before rushing in with solutions. Because I think that's another thing that's kind of just a marker of our technological society. It's always rushing in to make a solution instead of, wait and observe and study and then, and consider this over time, a bit of time.
Exactly. And this is the message that some of the indigenous people I've been working with lately are really honing in on, which is learn the story of place.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say learn the story of place, it's not like learn the whole story of the Los Angeles basin. It's like learn the story of that ridge right there.
Right.
Learn the story of that one drainage.
Mm-hmm.
Learn the story of that little valley, because each little landform has a different story, a different interaction, a different microclimate, a different soil type. And if we want to prepare for fire, we have to start reading the story of these different areas, because not every zone is going to burn. the way these big fires burn. But if we take the time to listen, we can clearly see the where the big fire zones are,
mm-hmm.
and then we can adjust our development patterns and our planning to make space for that.
So when you're interacting with these Native communities trying to discover these stories of place, were they mostly encouraging you to observe, or what were they encouraging you to do?
To take time to listen, to ask the right questions, to have an openness, you know, to be in a listening space. And like you were saying, this rush to go do, has to be, you know, implement solutions. I mean, I've always been sort of a go-getter, high-energy person, and I have a vision for something. I'm going to go out and make that happen. And, you know, 20 years of doing that, I'm finally starting to mature, I think.
It's a little counterproductive sometimes, right?
It's so counter. You know, how much waste have I created in trying to do the good thing?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's like so much waste. My energy's wasted. Materials are wasted. Other people. And it's like the only things that I've done in my life that are sustaining themselves ecologically, regeneratively, socially, economically, are the ones that took 10 years to build. And it was a dialogue the whole way. It was always pivoting and flexing. And this is what it is to work with natural systems, because one of the things I really like to teach my students is you're not just, when you're out on the land or in a community or in a culture, you're not just asking the what is happening. Okay, what's there? Oh, there's a redwood tree and there's a red-tailed hawk and there's a, you know, the soil's wet. But you're asking when. When are you in the landscape? Because natural systems function through succession. And fire is the beginning of a new succession. So if we start asking the question about when are we in the succession, you know, what would be a climax mature ecosystem in any given region? And where are you now in the succession? Well, if you can start to decipher that, then you can start working on what you can actually do now and build the foundation for that next succession. And I found this principle of working within the succession of evolution is just as important for developing organizations, developing businesses, is you start small, you go slow, and you listen all the way through.
Yeah, and allow that natural sequence. I mean, it kind of really goes back even to yoga of the creation, destruction, maintenance cycles and knowing where we are in that cycle.
Exactly.
I wanted to, we have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if there's any specific project you wanted to let our listeners know about. I know you have probably many, many regenerative projects on your plate, but is there something you want to just share with them real briefly?
Well, I wanted to tune people into the Permaculture Skill Center, which is it's a 5-acre demonstration site in Sebastopol, California, about an hour north of San Francisco. And it's open to the public. And one of the things we've done on this 5 acres is we've created a whole demonstration farm and gardens. There's thousands of feet of water harvesting systems and carbon farming is happening on the site. We've planted over 300 fruit and nut trees. So a lot of great demonstrations on the site. In fact, just in these last storms that we've had, we had about 5 inches of rain.
That's amazing.
We've caught already 500,000 gallons of water.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so fabulous.
it's just a feeling of abundance, you know. But the other aspect of it that I just wanted to mention is we're not just gardening the land, we're gardening the people too. And we've created what I would call a people guild of multiple organizations, businesses, and individuals that are managing the land and sharing resources. And
one
of the things that we do is we incubate farmers and provide access, land access, to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to have access. So that's a really cool model. Land access is one of the great issues of our time.
Yes.
Of our times. And especially when we think about regenerative design and shifting into a regenerative economy, this is going to be one of the big pillars that we need to crack to figure out how to make this shift.
Well, once people get back to the land, they start remembering what they're doing here. And you move away from a consumptive lifestyle. It just naturally happens.
And it's such a higher quality of life.
Sure. Absolutely. Our needs just become so much less.
The stress, just, you know, when you're in the garden, you're on the land in community, mm-hmm. when you experience that, the stress just composts back to the earth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see what really matters.
Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Could you give your website again and also maybe your Facebook page or whatever other links you can provide to the listeners so they can follow up with you or enroll in your Eco Mastery School or, you know, come up to Sebastopol and learn with others?
Absolutely. Oh, thanks so much for having me. So we've got permacultureskillcenter.org. Mm-hmm. That's where you can find out all about our different trainings. We have a lot of online trainings and we have some in-person trainings. And we also have permacultureartisans.com. That's my design contracting firm.
Okay.
And we design and build systems for folks. And there's also ericolson.com, where I have some books that I've written and some other projects up there.
Oh, yes. I know you have that new book coming out, Ecological Landscape Professional. Yes?
Yes,
people
exactly.
can pre-order
looking
that book.
To launch that in February.
Oh, thank you so much, Eric, it's been so wonderful having you on the show to really give people something to vision and something to dream toward because, you know, there's such an onslaught. I think once people get back into the ground and start planting things and, you know, working with others, and that is so inspiring. You can sustain yourself on that, you know, whereas just listening to the news or being, you know, every day is just kind of a hit. But if we get back into these communal spaces with people, everything changes.
Everything changes, and everything is possible. And there's a lot of hope in the garden. There's a lot of hope on the land.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Eric. We'll definitely bring you back on the show in the future. Thank you so much.
I look forward to it. Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Thank you, listeners. Tune in next time to EcoJustice Radio.
And that is it for our show. Thank you for tuning into Eco Justice Radio. I want to thank Eric for coming onto the show. Eco Justice Radio is brought to you by SoCal 350 and KPFK. Executive producer Mark Morris. Interview hosted by Carrie Kim and original music by Javier Cadre. My name is JP Morris, and until next time, remember, the power is yours.